Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center. I'm so excited to have a discussion with my friend Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Hello, and hi, listeners. I want to give a special shout out to Carol Jean.
Love it. And my friend on the right, John Dougal.
Hey, good to be with you, and shout out to Todd. Fact checking and giving input. So, yeah,
it's great. Hey, you two, LA.
Yeah.
My husband came home last night, and I was watching the NHL Stanley Cup Finals. He's like, what are you doing? I said, I don't want to watch the news right now.
Yeah.
Just this, you know.
There's a problem with 24-hour news, isn't there?
Yeah. And it's just this tedious coverage of, oh, you know, they broke a window here. Okay, now they're backing them down this street. Oh, you know, so-and-so got close.
There goes that Waymo car.
Yeah. They pulled out a club on this guy. And then meanwhile, you know, all this posturing. They'll interview the czar of the border and then interview the lieutenant governor of California. And it just is so much drama.
Yeah.
I'd rather watch hockey.
I mean, I just have to ask, I know that you're both not huge Trump fans, but I do think it's really important to acknowledge that we have crossed a pretty significant threshold for what is reasonable and normal in American society when it comes to the president basically saying, I'm taking control of the National Guard. We're going to deploy them in cities of my choosing. They can show up anywhere at any time. Now we're talking about Marines on American soil, which should, by definition, be the Insurrection Act. And to me, I just have to add that this is by a person who pardoned individuals who stormed our Capitol, beat the hell out of police officers, and just wipe the slate for those January 6th folks.
John, when I hear Shireen talk like this, I think of her debate.
She's so passionate.
When she ran for Congress, you're just so articulate and you're so measured about it. You know, and I get it.
Yeah.
What is it? Is it 400 Marines and about 4,000 National Guard troops? I heard the lieutenant governor of California, and she was pretty good. She said, you know, we had about 400 people protesting. That's well within our ability to
control,
to take care of. And, you know, there was no consultation. It was just slammed on us. And it just puts fuel on the fire, and this is going to get worse. And I think she made a pretty good case, John.
Yeah, but the law doesn't require consultation. The law just requires the president to just to notify the governor that this is taking place. The National Guard is one of those interesting beasts. It's two-headed. It's overseen by the governor and by the president.
Mm-hmm.
And under Title 10, the president, in cases of, you know, insurrection, potential insurrection, or to enforce, you know, federal law, can deploy the National Guard under his authority. And so there is nothing that I can see here which is contrary to the law. And this happens regularly, that various times in American history,
the
not too far
out of
back.
The does not happen regularly.
Well, I'm talking National Guard right now. So the other thing with the National Guard is they can't arrest people. So they can sit there and protect, you know, and ensure that federal law is being enforced. But, I mean, they can't arrest. And I want to just go back to, you know, Brown versus Board of Education. Uh-huh. Let's talk there. Eisenhower, I mean, the governor in Arkansas deployed the National Guard to keep the schools from being integrated. Eisenhower then put the National Guard under his authority, so took it away from the governor and deployed
Super
the 101st Airborne to then go enforce federal law to make sure that the school got integrated. And so, you know, to talk this is so odd. No, this regularly happens throughout U.S. history.
Yeah, okay, this is different. It just is. And I really have to acknowledge as well, I listened to a couple of different interviews about this and heard the governor say, you know, these are people who were pulled off of pretty serious work, continuing to work and respond to the wildfires, forest management so that we don't have more cities in California burning, fentanyl interventions and controls at the border. These are people who are being pulled from assignments that they have in the National Guard and being pulled into this without specific roles and to incite, I think, to escalate the violence and to get a response out of protesters so that he can continue, so that Trump can continue. And I think this is, we should watch this. This is a very serious moment.
But I think the overwhelming majority of the American public is actually on the president's side with this. When they sit there and they watch the news and they see property getting vandalized, cars getting destroyed, fire.
That is a
small
minority
the police,
of what's happening.
Yeah. Waving the Mexican flags and flags of other countries.
This is what the president wants.
But these protesters are actually feeding into the president.
So someone saw me the other day and they said,
helping the president.
I really like you on both sides of the aisle, but you don't speak up enough.
Okay, hit us with it.
Okay.
No, well, I mean, it just, come on. Like 400 people protesting, largest state in the country. They can handle that.
One of the largest police forces.
And then when I saw, I did watch a little bit on the news last night. They definitely had LAPD on the front lines, and then they had the county behind that. And the National Guard were way back at the federal building, not really doing much at all, I might say.
Yeah.
So I think they overstepped, John, too early and made it worse. They definitely have the right to do it. But let's keep in mind, this is a very helpful distraction to the president, meaning this is news that he loves, because we're not talking about all the other news, whether it's Elon Musk or whether it's the tariffs, whether it's, you know, what we're seeing in the economic data.
I just have to add one more point that I'm really concerned about. What this is in response to in LA are people showing up to immigration appointments, trying to follow the system that's in place and being restrained, being held. That, for me, says everything we need to know about this moment. This president is not interested in a functioning immigration system. These are people who showed up to appointments, tried to follow the law, and are now being detained.
The overwhelming majority of Congress isn't interested in a functional immigration. And we've talked about that. And we agree
and
about the need for...
it's also not happening in places like on farms in South Dakota, in meatpacking plants in Nebraska. It's intentionally happening in these
states. What do you think happens next, Shereen? And John, I'll ask you the same question.
I think that he's going to look for ways to continue to escalate it, because he is having such a failed moment in his presidency.
Mm-hmm. And maybe it's working for
maybe
him
working.
To have this on the news every night. John?
I think from his perspective, where he's going on the immigration push is working from his perspective. Now, I think, you know, I come from the perspective, okay, those that are violent criminals, yeah, we need to root them out. Okay. I don't have the same feeling when it's, you know, largely peaceful folks looking for a better life, overstayed their visa.
Trying to follow the rules.
And they're largely trying to follow the rules. But you know, that's a whole different thing to me than those that are violent criminals. And I think when the president, it all depends. If he's viewed as going after the dangerous criminals, then I think the public's going to back him. If he's viewed as getting too far away from that, then that's when he's going to lose more and more support.
Yeah, and I agree with you, John, on that point. That's critical to me. There is no question you want to get people that are harming Americans out of this country.
Right.
I agree with that, too,
yeah.
Just to be clear.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That is the most obvious point of all time.
But the critical thing, like in this market, I'm aware of a family on Sunday that's mother was taken by ICE agents. The father was not taken because he went early to a church meeting. This is an LDS family, been here for 20 years, have two children serving LDS missions right now.
Yeah.
So this gets pretty complicated in this community pretty quick.
Yep.
when you're taking law-abiding folks.
Yes, or people who are trying to follow laws that are deeply broken.
Yeah. Hey, in the remaining time, let's just go.
I just want to go back and note, when people flip on the TV, though, and see the violence and see what's going on, it sends a certain message to them.
Yeah, it's not a good look.
And like I said, it feeds into the president's narrative.
Okay, and when their neighbors are getting snatched for trying to follow the rules, that's also going to change the narrative.
Okay, we want to talk about Elon Musk and Donald Trump. Boy, we chatted last week. We talked about, you
romance
know,
gone wrong.
The disgusting abomination of a bill, but we had no idea what was going to go down the next day. My goodness, I thought it was fake.
Yeah.
I thought I was being fooled when I'm watching the back and forth of these
maybe
two.
Maybe you still are, but yeah.
They were like children in a sandbox. What, John?
Yeah.
I know you are, but what am I?
My dad's bigger than your dad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you've got Elon's, you know, calling the president a pedophile and says he should be impeached. Folks that are saying that, you know, on the president's side, saying that Elon should be, deported.
He's
an illegal immigrant, yada, yada, yada. So, yeah, it has gone really ugly. And I think understanding what I've seen is, a lot of this goes back to Musk made a recommendation for the head of the
NASA,
you know, and he cares a lot about that because of SpaceX. And, you know, the president got some Oppo research, which didn't look favorable on this guy. And it led to a major falling out between the two.
Yeah. I'm sure listeners will be not at all surprised if you've heard a single word out of my mouth that I find this to be deeply disturbing and just a real reflection of the level of immaturity of the individuals leading our country. But Natalie, I know you reflect a lot on leadership. I know that you reflect a lot on how people present themselves on social media. What do you think about all this?
Oh, I was asked today, I was at a meeting with a lot of Utah business leaders, and I was just asked on a panel conversation, if the president called, what advice would you give him? There I was, live fire. I said, get off Truth Social.
Yeah.
I said, quit calling people names and then resolve your tariff policies by the end of July so that we can get on with our economy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little bit of my quick thing. Hey, in the last minute and a half in this segment, let's talk about the RFK Jr. firing the entire CDC vaccination panel.
Yeah.
Ooh, this you know, I mean, he's going to bring in a new panel and they'll still make recommendations. And he's saying that this panel's conflicted and they all have conflicts. That's the nature of life a lot. They have a life. They disclose their conflicts, but they're scientists. Please don't undermine public health in this country.
I would just say this is exactly as bad as I thought it would be. I'm wondering if you two think it's as bad as you thought it would be.
I heard that NIH is down 5,000 workers in this administration. Now, John probably thinks that's smaller government. What I think is that's our public health institution.
Outbreak, right?
Yeah, being dismantled.
Yeah. Well, and this is one of the wild cards with Kennedy. You know, what was he going to do? I mean, we had good indications he was going to, you know, disrupt things heavily within, you know, HHS. But yeah, we're seeing that. Now, a lot of folks are going to be concerned with where he's at on vaccinations. I have concerns. I think generally they're more good than harm. And the hysteria, I think, goes too far in too many cases.
You sound too conflicted to be on this panel.
Yeah.
We know that RFK...
I see so many people that benefit from vaccinations and medical science. But I also see, you know, some people want to plaster over that there are some harms and some people that get injured as a result of them.
Yeah. We know that RFK Jr. went to Kamala Harris's campaign and said, I'll come to you if... And, you know, you promised me some positions in the new administration. She didn't go for it.
Nope.
Goes to Trump. He goes for it. Okay, whatever. I just never imagined that he'd make him head of HHS. That's the part that I find so troubling. This I would have put him in some minor role and got on with my politics.
This is a public health disaster. And if you're lucky enough to continue to have access to health care in this state, consult with your medical professionals.
We'll take a short break. Natalie Gochner with Shereen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned, everyone.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shereen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. Shereen, I want to go to you first and just talk about, what do you call it when you bring someone back from being deported?
Oh, my goodness, right.
De-deported?
De-deported.
But this Kilmar Garcia, he's back. He's in Nashville. He's going through a legal process. He's not been reunited with his family. But this is complicated.
This is complicated. I think there are a couple of important things here. This is why we were all talking about due process. Individuals, humans in this country, are afforded due process when they are grabbed by this government and deported under, there needs to be a process, basically. And when this happens.
And this process applies not just to citizens.
To everyone.
But to non-citizens.
That's correct. So Garcia was deported out of this country, sent to El Salvador. They said, the Trump administration across the board said, we're not bringing him back. In fact, the president of El Salvador said, I'm not giving him back. And then he's back. And he's back because they were going to lose in court. As far as I'm concerned, there is no justification for what happened to this individual. But now they have a very weak case. The documents that are associated with the case that he's being charged with apparently are very thin. There's not a lot of information in them. But at the very least, he gets a process, right? So this is a step in the right direction, but this is an absolute violation of human rights.
I can read the writing on the wall. He gets a process and he goes right back to El Salvador. John? That's what I think is going to happen.
You think so?
Mm-hmm.
Because a judge will do that? Or?
Yeah. I just think they knew what they were doing when they brought him back, and they knew that they could engineer this. That's just my gut feel. Maybe that sounds too conspiratorial. But
yeah, that sounds too conspiratorial.
Let's just watch what happens.
Yeah, let's watch what happens.
But I think going down that path, Natalie, I think it all depends on the strength of the case. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of those things. It's like lots of stuff was thrown around verbally, but there wasn't fully this allegation of these are the crimes. Now there's the chance to say, here are the crimes. Now, we've got a process, which means, okay, it's in the trial court, then it potentially goes to the appellate court, mm-hmm. then maybe or maybe not goes to the Supreme Court. There's a certain process there. And so we will have to see what is the evidence, what arguments do they make, what defense is there to see. I'm not the assumption that, oh, it's all going to go that way. But if there's enough, they shouldn't be bringing charges if they don't think they can make the case.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Okay, let's go to Congressman Blake Moore. Fascinating guy. Tall guy. Smart guy. Athletic guy. A guy that is on the Ways and Means Committee. And I'm just thrilled that someone like that is willing to do public service. This is really, because this is a guy that has a lot of options in life. But he's basically saying that the big, beautiful bill won't raise the national debt, or it won't create a deficit.
And what do you think as an economist? Tell me your thoughts.
He's making a really good point, right? That we have what we call static revenue, you know.
So we work kind of like we change tax policy and nothing happens economically.
Yeah.
Versus we all know there's going to be some give and take. And so
keep going. Yeah. So right now the Congressional Budget Office has said that the big, beautiful bill will create a $2.4 trillion added to the debt over the next 10 years. And if you include the interest payments, it's even $3 trillion. So it's two to three trillion.
Uh-huh.
Different folks have argued a little bit more, a little bit less, but it's in there. But what Congressman Moore is saying is that assumes a 1.8 GDP growth. And he thinks that the policies in the bill, the tax cuts, the stimulatory things, the things that are helpful to the economy will actually have the economy grow at 2.6%. That's called a dynamic forecast. And when the economy grows, revenues increase.
Yeah.
So it's this big debate among, you know.
And it's a valid debate.
Economists, about static versus dynamic revenue forecasts. But
we have that debate here in Utah in our legislature.
But the one thing they don't think about is that, revenues might grow up if the economy grows, but so do costs. So that's something that he's not talking about here. Mm-hmm. You know, as the economy grows, you have more expenditures as well.
Yeah.
I think this bill has to change. I think it will change. I'm looking for the overtime tax cuts to go away. I'm looking for the tip tax cuts to go away. I'm looking for
for working people.
Auto loan. Yeah, I'm looking for all those to go away. I think it's bad tax policy.
How about the billionaires?
Well, I don't mind the way they're expensing business costs for R&D and for depreciation. I think it helps the little guy.
This is Natalie's trickle down economics of which I share.
I know.
But the things I said there, I'm making the tax cuts smaller so that the deficit is also smaller.
But also what you're saying is there are certain tax cuts that are more likely to drive the economy and there's tax cuts that aren't. And
they drive politics.
They're driving votes. Politics. And you've highlighted the ones that drive politics more than actually driving the economy and the growth that, you know, Congressman Moore thinks he's going to get out of the tax bill.
Okay, unless you're working for tips. I mean, those are real dollars that are coming right back into your community.
All sorts of distortion, Shereen. So all of a sudden, American
but
business
so change,
well, changes things so that you have more tips and you have more overtime to be more competitive. And so
to gain the tax system.
Yeah, you
gain
because you don't take taxes sitting down.
Low tax.
So there's just a better way. And so what I want to do is I want the senators to get in a room and say, let's tone back the ones that help the wealthy. Let's get rid of these bad tax policy. Let's have some more cuts. I mean, I'd like to go after entitlements more, but I would do it in the retirement age and things like that.
So I just have to add that I think Congressman Moore is a more thoughtful representative of the ones I've interfaced with.
We are lucky to have that man.
And I will
is
also
that one out of four, or one out of six.
I'm not telling you. And then I will say this. I think for this math, this is exactly what Democrats said on the infrastructure bill. And Republicans said, no, we don't get to count that. So this is really ridiculous to me. I also find it really difficult to swallow from a person who was co-chairing DOGE. And as we're seeing more and more reporting, the federal government is scrambling to rehire people who were cut in that process. That is not a process that saved this government any money. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's starting to look like it's going to cost us. I think these are fundamental calculations that make me question his judgment.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Hey, this is something I just want to bring up because Shereen brought up, maybe socioeconomic standing, those sorts of things. Utah ranked number 4 for child well-being in the Annie Casey latest numbers. I thought that was great to see.
Yeah, it's
number
good to
4.
See.
And like we're with Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont. We're with all these New England states. Go Utah.
I love this. I will just also say the thing that frustrates me about Utah, I think this is great news. It also says to me that the gap in the problem for us is still solvable. We're big enough that we have the opportunity to solve it. The problem is small enough that we could go after it and fix it. Last count, I remember it was just under 1,400 kids in Utah are homeless. That's a solvable problem.
Totally.
Right?
And we ought to go right after
we
that.
We got to go right
and
after it.
And it will save us money if we go after
yes,
it.
Yes, and we should be number one.
Make their lives better.
Yeah.
John, I don't know if you saw that study, but I think it's so. Lois Collins with the Deseret News, one of their best writers. She's been around forever, and she specializes in this topic. But the place where we don't do well is in housing costs. Too many of our households, lower income households, spend way too high of a percentage of their income on housing. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the concerns. And it's a multifaceted problem, partly driven at the federal level, partly at the state level, partly at the local government level. But I mean, at state level, we've taken actions to entice more people to Utah, which has caused a housing constraint.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things. But, you know, we have zoning issues and there's questions at the local level. What can you actually do with your property?
Yeah.
You know, how can you develop it? What are the constraints? You know, you get the right number of votes on a city council and all of a sudden you can alter that. And you know,
how hard are the neighbors going to fight?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but this is one of, there's a lot of, you know, not in my backyard.
Yeah.
But this is one of those, I totally can see how that can be a major issue.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, Natalie, I know you've been tracking some big dates that are coming up.
Oh.
I'm wondering if you want to talk to us a little bit about that.
I just think we're in the quiet before the storm.
You do?
Yes.
Yeah, tell me what you mean.
So, you know, I'm an economist by training. I'm always thinking about how the data is shaping up. I'm also thinking about things in the future that will affect the economic forecast. And if you remember, we had Liberation Day April 2nd. The president didn't want it to be April Fool's. So it was April 2nd. This is when he announced his reciprocal tariffs.
Wasn't the gift I was looking for on my birthday.
By the 9th, he rescinded, you know, put him on pause for 90 days. And so that's the first milestone, is that July 9th is that next moment when we learn about what's going on with the reciprocal tariffs.
Are they going to go back in place or not?
Yeah. Well, there's only been two trade deals that I'm aware of. One was with the UK, which we already have a trade surplus with and is a major ally. No big news there. Mm-hmm. The other one with is China. Huge news there. But that's the other date because that deal was made later.
We don't really have an agreement, or do we actually have an
paused.
Agreement?
We brought it down.
Paused.
It was 145.
We brought it down. But we don't have an agreement.
By August 12th, that one expires.
Yeah.
So you're going to get another date there. But then you've got the big, beautiful bill that everyone knows that the House and Senate Congress takes August off basically in our country. That's every year.
Yeah.
And so by the 2nd and by the 3rd, they're both gone. So that bill, I think, has to pass by August 1. I think it'll go right to the last minute, my guess. And it's really consequential because they have to pass it for continuing resolution. So they, you know, don't need the 60 votes. And they also have to pass it because they got a debt ceiling. So that's my fascination with dates.
Yeah.
Is you've got to have a great 4th of July, everyone, and then it's going to get crazy.
It's going to be wild.
I got to love the August recess.
Yeah.
It goes back to when D.C. was a swamp.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So, John, you served in the legislature for many, many years. Tell us how leadership elections work, because we had Jefferson Moss, who left at the House Majority Leader to become the head of economic development for our state, and that shook up the House leadership races. And now we've got Casey Snyder as the Majority Leader, Candace Perucci as the Majority Whip, and Representative Bollender as the Assistant Whip.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
How does it work?
So this is the one vote that legislators get to make in secret, okay? Nobody sees what their vote is.
How do they do it? You write it on paper? How do you do it?
You, like, write it on paper, you drop it in.
So they do it the old-fashioned way.
Not even electronic. Not even electronic. You drop it in, they go in another room, they go count them, you've got a poll
watcher.
This
is why Nolan Karras used to say, you know, I'm assured of 80 votes.
Uh-huh.
Because there's only 74 in the House?
75 in the House.
This is why it's private. They tell you.
This is why, you know, I won the election with 30 votes, but I got to write 45 thank you cards.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, okay. People
and,
will
and the
tell
staff
you
just
or
administer
lead you to believe.
It. The staff just administer it. And which one do they do first?
Usually we do speaker first, and then you work
so
your
Mike
way down.
So Mike Schultz was up again.
Well,
for,
he wasn't up, but
okay,
he was always
going
to
say
speaker, but
that.
You start at the top and you work your way down.
So
and
House
sometimes
Majority
by the time you get to the bottom, it's a little bit of a consolation prize sometimes.
Put your name on a board and your colleagues vote on it. And then if you don't get that spot, you can also be a candidate for the one below.
Maybe one lower. Maybe, maybe not. It all depends.
And do they put the numbers up on the board so you know?
Typically not.
Just wondering.
Typically not. I mean, the only time you really know the numbers is if you have a tie. Now, sometimes the poll watchers know what it is, but oftentimes what happens is once you hit the threshold that you win, then you stop counting.
Shireen, you represent the minority party, but what would you say about all this?
Oh, anything? Well, I guess the question I have is, do you think that this changes the dynamic? Because I don't know these legislators well, but I would say that it feels like a different vibe from the previous group. A little bit more of a workhorse group, I think. I don't. What do you think?
Casey Snyder's not someone I know well, but I'm telling you, he's very smart.
Very smart.
Very well-rounded, you know, intelligent guy.
He's going to be, I consider him more hard-charging than Jeff Moss. I would say Jeff Moss was more of, you know,
consensus,
let's collaborate, let's try and work this out.
Yeah.
Casey's much more, boom, we're plowing forward and this is the direction we're going. So I think that will that will influence the caucus some.
So stay tuned. Hey, on our last segment, we just have like 45 seconds or so, but what do you want to say about this story, Shireen, about LDS voters are getting less Republican, but they like Trump more than ever?
Oh, yeah.
That's weird.
Is it, or is it a bit of populism? I mean, I think that's the question that I would have. I would love to learn more about this and really understand. But I do think, when I think about the popularity of Bernie in this state, when I think about the growing popularity around Trump, I do think something is common there.
I want to understand this better. John, quick comment on it.
Yeah, it's just kind of interesting. I mean, getting less Republican, I don't know if that means they're getting more Democratic or they're going more independent.
But I don't know if it means they like Trump or don't.
Picking and choosing. I know Trump has been a lightning rod in the Republican Party. Some love him, some don't.
Yeah, we'll talk more in future editions of Both Sides of the Aisle. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gurbani and John Dugal. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.